individual arguments has the strength of a mathematical proof. Okay, let's start out with the equation for the distribution function f. F, as you recall, is n, if we have lots of independent particles, n of them. F is n times the probability of rho of prt. It then represents the probability density for finding a particle in the neighborhood of PR. But if we have independent particles, non-relativistic ones, it's most reasonable to use a Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m. And the use of that Hamiltonian gives you, on the left-hand side, the time derivative plus this is equal to 0. And then you say, that takes into account the average forces on the particles, its average motion because of momentum. This term is the particle is moving with velocity p over m, and that because of that motion, the distribution function changes. This says that the momentum of the particle is changing because there's a force on it, and because the momentum of the particle changes, there's a time derivative due to that. And then we have one more thing that we want to think about, which you actually taught about some two lectures ago in the field theory course, namely, you want to think about the effect of collisions. Particle with momentum p comes in, bumps into a particle with momentum q, and the two particles come out and change momentum. P prime and Q prime.
Sorry.
I didn't turn it on.
I think I got it. Thank you. So what we have is particles coming in with momentum p and q and going out with momentum p prime and q prime. They do something in here. You, in your field theory course, wrote down a few diagrams, what they might do. You sum up a whole bunch of diagrams, and you get the probability of scattering. In classical mechanics, there is also a probability of scattering. You figure out what the offset of the two particles coming in is going to be, how much they miss by. That how much they miss by determines how much they get scattered, and you describe the whole thing by a differential cross-section, just as you would in particle physics. I'm not going to specify what's in here. I'm going to put in symbols for it. I'm not going to tell you much about it. Well, the argument that we're going to go through is sort of independent of what you actually put in for this collision. However, you need to look at collisions in both senses. That is, this is a collision in which a particle with momentum p comes in, bounces off of a particle with momentum q. That will reduce the number of particles with momentum p sitting around. This should produce something with a minus sign on the right-hand side of the equation. There is another process which goes backwards, in which particles with momentum p prime and q prime come in, and particles with momentum p and q go out. This should increase the number of particles around with a momentum p in the neighborhood of the space-time point rt. So let's see what this says. Given that there are particles available with the appropriate initial momentum, p, and the appropriate initial momentum, q, the scattering rate is proportional to a volume element of the final momentum, dp prime, dq prime, and can be written as dp prime times dq prime times something called q of p and q goes into p prime, q prime. This is a function initially of the two of the four vector variables representing the vector momentum. I'm not going to specify it. I will specify it only slightly more precisely. The probability that we get the factors we need for this collision, this one up here, we need to have particles around with momentum q, the density of such particles in the neighborhood of momentum q, in the neighborhood of the space-time point r at the time t, is this guy. We need to have particles around with momentum p. That's this guy. We integrate over all of the particles that you might scatter over. We integrate over all the particle states you might scatter into, and you get a term which looks like f of p rt times f of q rt integrated dq dp prime dq prime times this scattering rate. That's something we're going to give a minus sign to and stick it on the right-hand side of the equation which Boltzmann originally wrote down. However, we also need to consider the backward process. And exactly the same logic gives the result of the backward process. We have particles coming in with momentum p prime and q prime. We've got to figure out what the probability of having such particles is as proportional to dp prime dq prime times f of p prime r and t, f of q prime r and t. We've got to let these particles go into the final state. That's just the same thing written backwards, the probability that p prime and q prime will go into p and q. And then we integrate over everything inside dq, dp prime, dq prime. Our assumption is that this r represents an approximate place where the collision occurs. We don't take into account the offsets that I told you determine the actual collision rate. We say that this is a black box. Well, it's a gray circle, but it's a black box that into which the scattering goes, and it's from the point of view of what we're doing all at one point in space. I should take a deep breath, let you look at this, and tell you that we're going to write down the same equation once more with minus this term plus that term on the right-hand side, and that's going to be our representation of Boltzmann's equation. Yes, please. Of course, I'm looking at a particle p. I'm fixing p. Okay. The next equation, it does what I said it did. I'm going to show it to you and then tell you why I shouldn't integrate over momentum p. I'm looking at the time derivative of this of the probability that I can find around a particle with p and r in the neighborhood of the time t. I'm looking at the time dependence of that. The point in space is fixed. The time is fixed. The momentum p is fixed. Then all of the other momenta are described the possible ways things can happen to this particle. They are to be integrated over. Okay? We've got tons of symbols here. I got lazy and decided I wasn't going to write so many symbols. So in the next equation down, instead of writing f of prt, I just write f of p, and you must understand that everything happens in the neighborhood of the space-time point rt. However, I also need to take into account the conservation laws. This collision will not occur unless we conserve momentum, this delta function, is a delta function which conserves the three momenta. And it will not occur unless we conserve energy. This is a delta function which conserves energy. When we take this factor out, there's a remaining factor r which we will assume is smoothly varying and non-zero in the remaining variables. So nothing much has happened. I've replaced Q by R times delta functions, and the equation looks like. It is a partial differential equation, or rather it's a partial integral differential equation, because it's got integrals, in six variables, seven counting time, and it is nonlinear and has all kinds of mess in it. This is what it looks like. Nothing has happened between here and here, except that instead of writing one integral sign, I wrote three. And instead of writing an f of prt, I wrote f of p prime rt, replace this by that. And instead of writing q, I wrote r times delta functions. This equation right here, with an appropriate replacement for r, given the rate of collision, is the equation that Boltzmann asked us to consider. Okay?
So if your Hamiltonian is independent of time and all the collisions are elastic, so why does the epsilon for the energy here depend on time?
It doesn't. That is. Okay, let me do several problems at once. Imagine I have this box of silver gas and nothing much is going on inside the box. All I have is the heating going on. Inside the box, I will use this equation and I will use this stuff in which the potential U is independent of time. P is clearly independent of time. Imagine, however, for a moment, that I ionized this silver gas that became a bunch of charged particles. I can do that by putting in more candles or something. So the gas gets ionized, and I apply an electric field. Okay, I apply electric field. U becomes contains a term which is the charge, which is an electric potential. And this is a force, so it's the electric potential times the charge on the ion, gradient with respect to R. If that potential varies in time, there's time dependence in here. If I have, in addition, a vector potential to represent a magnetic field, I replace this gradient R by gradient R minus E over C times the vector potential. And that can be dependent on time. So with just a little bit of changes, we can represent sort of a much broader class of problems. However, I'm not going to let you think at this moment about any situation here more complicated than the motion of individual particles. Later on, we talk about Fermi gases. We'll talk about more complicated things a little bit. Here, I just want individual weakly coupled particles represented by their momentum in a term of the Hamiltonian p squared over 2m, and represented by the fact that they're moving through a potential, maybe just a potential that holds them inside the box. And I'm going to think about the situation in right now in which potential is independent of time, as is the mass of the particle. Further questions or comments? We need one more statement, or rather, we need roughly two more statements to get big deal conclusions out of this Boltzmann equation. One is a statement of what is called detailed balance. This R is a rate of collisions in which PQ goes into P prime, Q prime. That direction, direction of the arrow. And we've already taken into account momentum and energy conservation. This is a rate once those things have been taken into account. The statement of detailed balance is that the rate of going forward is the same as the rate of going in the opposite direction. That is a consequence of classical mechanics. It's true of a Hamiltonian formulation of classical mechanics. The equivalent thing in particle physics is true to a very high order of accuracy, but is not 100% true, because there is, in fact, we have observed violations of time reversal invariance in particle physics. It's also not quite true in the presence of a magnetic field. We'll leave out the magnetic field for now. We will leave out the non-obeying time reversal invariance. We will make this assumption, and then the Boltzmann equation simplifies to this form. I remind you of what it was before it simplified, and then I'll show you again the simplification. So I'm going back one. Yes. Here we have the R for going forward, and we go forward. Here we have the R for going backwards, and we go backwards. These are two different terms. The arrow goes from the first thing becomes the last thing of this term. What I'm saying is that you can replace PQ by P prime, Q prime, flipping here and there, and get one factor in front of everything. The equation then becomes this guy. There's one more symmetry statement that we're going to use in a little bit. That symmetry statement is that P and Q are the same kind of particle, so that I can replace P and P prime by Q and Q prime and get the same thing out. This is the symmetry between the two particles. If we had identical particles in quantum mechanics, we'd have one more statement. But since we don't need, in which the P prime, Q prime is replaced by Q prime, P prime, but we don't need that for deriving what we want to have. So we have, first of all, the detailed balance, that you go in the same direction in the probability, you go in opposite direction in time, the probability is the same. You have, secondly, a symmetry between the particles labeled by P and the particles labeled by Q. That and the structure that Boltzmann wrote down is all you need. What do I mean that's all you need? Here you have f of p times f of q times f of p prime times f of q prime. Let me make the assumption that Maxwell and Boltzmann were right all along, and I could replace rho by e to the minus beta h, or f by e to the minus beta h, so that except for constants, which I won't write down, the f of p times f of q minus f of p prime times f of q prime is some constants, put a wiggle for proportional to, e to the minus beta. This is the inverse temperature expressed in energy units. This is the energy for that particle p. I get the same thing for the particle q. I get a minus sign, because I got a minus sign there, e to the minus beta epsilon of p prime minus beta epsilon of q prime. light dawns as soon as you see this structure, as soon as you see that structure. If you have this delta function right there, these two things cancel, and this is set equal to zero. That is detailed balance gives us, without further ado, the assumption that we could have moved this factor out in front, gives us, without further ado, the Maxwell-Boltzmann structure. If we wanted to do a little bit more, we could say that whatever the solution to this equation, given these delta functions and the statement that this thing is smooth, doesn't go to zero anyplace much, is that f of p rt is an exponential of some function beta of rt, depending on space and time, times some epsilon of prt, same epsilon as in here, minus mu, that's these constants written down, or not written down there, which might depend on rt. And then we might have a velocity, and the conventional way of writing the velocity, we might have momentum times the velocity, since the conservation of momentum works exactly the same way as the conservation of energy. We might have a p dot v term, where the v depends on r and t. And in order to make things pretty, we'll put in a v squared over 2m. That just enables us to complete the square here and to say that we're looking at things in a coordinate system moving with velocity v. I'll get you in a sec, just want to make noises. This is called an assumption of local thermodynamic equilibrium. Local because we have beta depending on R and T. It is a consequence of the Boltzmann equation and our statement that the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation is equal to zero. Question, comment?
In the previous slide, you said if particles are identical in quantity sense, then it could also stop the final statement. Why is that? Why is there a difference?
Classically identical means that you can follow them by sitting on top of them. Just quantum mechanically identical means you can't sit on top of them. All you can do is say that they're the very same thing and have a symmetrical wave function in the variables in question. The wave function is symmetrical, you can't tell a difference between the q prime and the p prime. And if you can't tell a difference, you're supposed to be able to interchange them perfectly nicely. Same is true also of the p and q. That is, if I am doing classical physics, and I was talking about two particles, I might have an f of p and q, in which p and q are different from one another, and represented two different particles. However, whenever I did this using quantum mechanics of identical particles, I have to be sure that this is symmetrical under the interchange of p and q. That's a statement that the wave function, which is basically how we represent the particles in the end, is a symmetrical function of p and q. It is psi of q and p equally well. Plus and minus sign, depending on what the statistics is.
The first statement is
the classical one. First statement is the classical one, and it's all you need for this argument. The second statement is frosting on the cake. It's the quantum mechanical one, and not needed for the argument, and not known for Boltzmann.
Why is there such a distinction between the? Because the first statement is a statement about the initial state, and the second statement is a statement about the final state.
Ah, thank you. You take this and put it together with that. You then discover that you can equally well interchange P and Q. These two things together mean that you can make a statement in which this thing is equal to R of QP goes into P prime Q prime. Thank you. forward. Okay. Okay. Now I will spend, local thermodynamic equilibrium will, since beta, mu, and v depend on R and T, the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation is not necessarily satisfied by this assumption of local thermodynamic equilibrium. If, in fact, the energy, epsilon, the thing written here, was equal to p squared over 2m plus u, then, in fact, you get zero out of the left-hand side from the gradient R terms and the gradient P terms. I'm not at this instant capable of doing this momentum.v term in my head. We may run into trouble from it, but I don't think so. No, it's just a shift in the origin of the momentum, and shifts in the origin of momenta can be done without changing anything at all. Okay. That's what the v squared is there for, to make sure there's just a shift in the origin of momentum. The mu of RT does nothing much at all, and the whole thing works if this epsilon is the same as p squared over 2m plus u. It works except that this beta, this mu, and this v depend on space and time. I want to focus particularly on the space dependence and say we get extra terms proportional to the gradient in space of temperature, local velocity, local chemical potential. Those extra terms drive additional terms in the Boltzmann equation and then drive currents which make for constitutive equations like the constitutive equation I've told you about and make for the hydrodynamic equations which come out of the Boltzmann equation in the limit in which this is true. This is true when there is slow variation in time so that the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation doesn't matter much, slow variation in both space and time. So left-hand side doesn't matter much. The right-hand side is zero. And we then have to take into account small deviations from this result, driving what goes on the left-hand side of the equation. I'm not going to tell you more about that. I'm going to tell you about formal properties of the Boltzmann equation. In the 1920s, however, Chapman and Enskog solved the Boltzmann equation, got out of it a whole bunch of transport coefficients, like the viscosity of the dilute gas, and then compared those results with the viscosity of the dilute gas, the sound velocity of the dilute gas, and so forth, with experimental results, and convinced themselves that this approach was giving the right answers. I want to talk about conservation laws next. I'm going to talk about formal properties of the Boltzmann equation so that we can convince ourselves that what we're doing is more or less correct in writing this equation. Here's the Boltzmann equation again. I'm going to integrate this equation over all P and R. As I integrate the equation over all P and R, I pick up terms which are great proportional to gradients. This gradient of R term then gives me a result which is proportional to a gradient, and that then can be integrated to give results at the boundary of the system, and I'm going to assume that the system is very large and nothing much happens at the boundary of the equation. So let me write down what I'm doing, and we can then talk about whether it makes any sense. first thing I do is integrate dp dr. No, I'm sorry. Yes, integrate dp dr. This thing comes out because this gives us no boundary terms at infinity. This thing comes out because this gradient gives us boundary terms at infinity in momentum space. We get nothing. This becomes the time derivative of the total number of particles in the system. On the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation, you get an integral over p, q, p prime, and q prime, the number of collisions going forward and the number of collisions going backward. After just a little bit of manipulation, which involves going back and putting this r in the way it was before, going forward in this term and backward in this term, you convince yourself that the right-hand side also vanishes. You then get the statement that the time derivative of the total number of particles in the system is equal to zero. Okay. But now let's, in fact, do something a little bit less destructive than integrating over both p and r. We're going to integrate over just p, not r. On the left-hand side, when we integrate over just p, we get the integral dp of f of p, r, and t, time derivative. That's what the first term looks like, which is the time derivative of the density of particles at r and t. This is the number of particles per unit volume in the space at the space-time point rt. That takes care of this term. This term has in it a gradient p, and this term gives us zero. This term gives us a total derivative with respect to r. It's on the left-hand side of the equation. It's total derivative with respect to r, the integral dp p over m times f of p, r, and t, which we call the particle current. Integration over p kills off this right-hand side completely. There are many particles scattering in one direction, scattering in the other direction, and we're left with an equation, which I guess is not on this slide, but is on the next slide, I think. So I already told you, you get out this and this, and now I'm saying that all together what you get out is a local version of the particle conservation law. The time derivative of the density of particles is equal to the divergence of a current. This just repeats what I said before. So I'll let you stare at that for a moment. Aside from exercise and integration and taking boundary terms at infinity, this is just a statement that if the total number of particles scattering forward in any given region is equal to the total number of particles scattering backward, the result of doing the integration over p that you mentioned. One more. What happened to the integration? Okay, let me get my glasses on and figure out what happened. I'm missing a slide as far as I'm concerned. However, I'll tell you what's in the slide, and I'm not entirely sorry that I'm missing it. Maybe I'm missing it on purpose for all I know. Okay. The missing slide. Does the following. It multiplies the equation by p and integrates dp, f of p r t. In the missing slide, don't want the H theorem, that's the back one. In the missing slide, this term turns into the time derivative of the total of the momentum density, the density of momentum in the neighborhood of the space-time point RT. That density of momentum is called g of RT usually. It is in fact equal to the mass times j of RT. Of course, the velocity and the momentum are related by a factor of m. As you integrate, this term gives you a total derivative in R space. It is the derivative of a simple approximation to the stress tensor. This term gives you something, which is the extra momentum you get because the potential is giving you a force, and that force is adding momentum to the system. Then you do an integral dp, that is four integrations, p, q, p prime, and q prime, of p times this whole mess. After you play some games using the symmetry properties that I talked about, except for the one that's appropriate for quantum mechanics, using the two classical symmetry properties, what you end up with is you end up multiplying this whole thing using those symmetry properties by a factor which is p plus q minus p prime plus q prime, all divided by 4. I don't care about the 4, but since this thing vanishes because of this delta function, I get momentum conservation. The time derivative of the momentum density plus the divergence of a stress tensor plus the average momentum that I'm adding to the system at this point is equal to the resulting change in momentum because of the collisions of particles. And via Newton's action equals a reaction, that, essentially what we're doing here, that term vanishes. Now, that's a very exciting result. We would have been very disappointed with Boltzmann's equation if it did not include momentum conservation. An identical argument will give us energy conservation. Now we're going to get something out which you might not have expected. I'm not sure whether Boltzmann expected it or not. It's interesting to contrast Dirac and Boltzmann. Dirac was a very careful, meticulous guy who would phrase everything in the best possible mathematical language and would think everything through to the last iota and epsilon. Boltzmann was a sort of bull who charged ahead. And I could imagine him doing everything in the world to his equation. Oh, there's the momentum conservation argument, but I gave it to you. I don't have to give it to you again. I could imagine Boltzmann's charging ahead and multiplying his equation by every possible thing and integrating just to see what would happen. I'm not sure how he did it, but let's go on and say what happened. Boltzmann then multiplied the equation by the logarithm of f of p, r, and c, and integrated over all t. Go back to the structure of the equation and show you something about it. There's the equation. Help. Where did I put the eraser? One over there. Nope, that's not an eraser. Where did I put the eraser? Maybe I didn't put the eraser, but I don't have one. Thank you. Ah, thank you. So I did put the eraser. Thank you. So, Boltzmann took his equation and multiplied it by integral dp f logarithm of f of p, r, and t. The first term he had to deal with was the time derivative of f. The time derivative of f times log f is the term that you have here that is equal to the time derivative of f times log f. And then you have an addition when you differentiate that logarithm, the time derivative of f. The logarithm gives you a 1 over f, so that gives you an f, so you just get the time derivative of f. Except for stuff that you have had before, what you are then left with, except for this time derivative, which under the integration with t is just the particle density, you're left with a time derivative of f log f. The next term under the derivative, under the integral sign, gives us a stuff we had before, which incidentally cancels, times the gradient of t over m f log f, and is the gradient of an integral dt, and is the gradient of a current which we could call the current of log f, or if we wanted to be provocative, we could point out where we're going and say that that term was going to be the current of minus the entropy density. And now we keep on going. On the right-hand side of the equation, I'm not going to talk about the contribution of the external force to the change in entropy. It's something one can figure out, but it's a bore. It turns out to be something reasonable. We have an integral over 1, 2, 3, 4 momenta. Couple of delta functions. This r thing. And I call the result of doing that integration, script r, the integration is of the product of the f's times log f. OK, now I'm going to go back to this blackboard and tell you what I can do in order to simplify the equation. I have product of stuff times log f of p. Since the equation is symmetrical under the interchange of p and p prime with q and q prime, I could just as well have the log f of p plus the log f of q divided by 2. This is a replacement that doesn't change anything on the right-hand side of the equation. I could then talk about the exchange of p and q, p prime and q prime. going backwards versus going forwards. And as I talked about that, I would notice that I could replace this structure by the logarithm of f of p plus the logarithm of f of q divided by 4 minus the logarithm of f of p prime, f of q prime. I'm just making use of the various symmetries in the equation, the symmetry between p and q and p prime, q prime, and the symmetry between going forwards and backwards in time. The result is called R. And now comes a piece of intellectual fireworks. Those of you who are great readers of mystery stories can imagine what the solution of this mystery story is. The detective comes in and says, you've got this R here. And it says, well, tell me, please, what wonderful thing happens at the end of the book? Why are we making all this noise? What great thing happens? There's a great thing that happens here. What would we like to happen for entropy? Okay, I'll give you the first hint. The detective says, written down on Boltzmann's tombstone, as I said before, was the statement that entropy is related to this F log F business. What would we like to have happen for the time dependence of the entropy density? Not entirely right. Keep on going. You're almost there. Or somebody else keep on going. Is the derivative always positive? Right. Okay, good. We solved the mystery, as usual, at least for me. Sometimes I get the mystery, sometimes I don't. But now let me show you how the mystery works. It's on the next slide or thereafter. Okay, this slide does log f plus log f of p plus log f of q. This slide does what I did there too, log f of p plus log f of q minus f of p prime minus log f of q prime, all divided by 4. We now use the not especially deep relationship that log a plus log b is the logarithm of a times b. And this becomes the log f of p times f of q minus the log f of p prime times f of q prime. Okay, let me write down what the structure of this is. An ugly blackboard. Okay, let me write down what the structure of this is. Let me call f of p times f of q. Let me call that x. And f of p prime minus f of q prime, let me call that y. The next two factors I can't name because they've already been named for me. They are log x minus log y. If x is bigger than y, what is this? What is the sign of it? If x is bigger than y, this guy is positive, this guy is positive, it has a plus sign. If x is less than y, this guy is negative, this guy is negative. They're both positive definite quantities. If x is less than y, this guy is negative, this guy is negative. We have two minus signs, they have a plus sign. Either way, we get a plus sign here, so that because of this minus sign, the behavior of h is to decrease in time. Only when x equals y, the situation that we called local thermodynamic equilibrium, would we ever get zero, and would we ever get the entropy being non-changing? So we get the derivative of this quantity, H, the amount of heat, minus the density of entropy, plus the gradient of the current of heat, plus the term for the force, which I haven't thought about, is equal to R. R increases, so the amount of heat increases. R decreases, so the amount of heat decreases. The entropy, which is minus that, always increases in time. This, I think, is an amazing achievement. Amazing, amazing, amazing. When Boltzmann did that, the existence of molecules was far from a certain thing. He followed his idea, his vision, that the gas contained molecules, wrote down an equation, amazing specificity, and an equation which we believe essentially remains correct to this day, and then got all kinds of exciting consequences from this equation, including the consequence that you had an entropy which uniformly increases. That's a wonderful, exciting thing to happen. And I'm going to take the remaining 17 minutes to make, first of all, I'm going to stand there with my mouth open thinking about what a wonderful thing Boltzmann did. This person who was not as subtle as Planck or Einstein, who didn't have the mathematical command that maybe Gibbs had, who was not in any way cautious, who just rushed in and said things, managed to rush in and say just the right things for this guest. Now, what we would like to have, questions or comments? What we would like to have is a more general treatment which gives, in a more general way, the conditions for thermodynamic equilibrium. We know that thermodynamic equilibrium is not a property of a dilute gas. It is a property of all kinds of systems if you let them sit long enough. Not always, but almost always, if you let them sit long enough, they will come to thermodynamic equilibrium. If they have a Hamiltonian, which is independent of time, if they're described by either quantum mechanics or classical mechanics, if they don't fall into a glassy behavior, if they don't get stuck somehow, they will then relax to equilibrium. So I'm going to next consider two systems, a blue system and a brown system, and go through an analog of Boltzmann's argument for the blue system and the brown system, trying to make it more general. This argument, the argument I'm going to present here, is an argument which has been put together in the last 20 years, I believe. I haven't explicitly seen it in the literature, but I'm essentially sure that it exists in the literature in several different forms, and it's just a question of finding it. The work of, for example, Cohn and E.D.G. Cohn and Galavati is based upon some of the ideas I'm about to present. So I will take two systems, one called blue and the other called brown. I will let them interact weakly with one another. They will just touch and exchange heat. And now I'm going to be talking about what happens when they exchange heat. The systems are here. They touch someplace in this box here. And the places they touch, I want you to think of this as a weak interaction between systems themselves that have within themselves strong interactions. The process, two different subsystems with phase space described by coordinates x and y come together. They interact and go into a new situation described by x prime and y prime. We want to calculate how that interaction works on these guys. And, okay, I can copy Boltzmann. The rate of going into from the space, from the phase space volume xy into a small point in phase space with volume dx and volume dy around xy into the volumes dx prime dy prime is r of xy goes into x prime y prime. We're about to use a detailed balance that you go backwards and you get the same thing. That's usable because, in fact, these are Hamiltonian systems and the space phase volume doesn't change, so I don't have to mess around with how dx and dy are related to x prime and y prime. Now I will follow your prescription. I will calculate the total rate of going from xy in the volume element dx dy to x prime y prime in the volume element dx dy prime. And I will call that rate of going from one to the other r. I will then look at the inverse process. X prime and y prime goes into xy. I will call that rate r of x prime y prime goes into xy. Say that the rate for the inverse process is proportional to a distribution in phase space, which is f of x prime and t times g of y prime and t. I didn't say it up here, but the rate of going forward is f of x and t times g of y and t, where these are the density, where these are the probability densities of phase space for respectively the blue and the brown guy. This is a direct copy of what Boltzmann said, with the exception that I am going to do more integrations, and that I haven't put in, I haven't told you what x prime and y prime, x and y, they're just volumes in phase space. I'm thinking of this situation in several different situations. Maybe this has 10 to the 23rd particles in it, and this has three particles. Maybe this each have 10 to the 23rd particles. Maybe, or maybe, maybe, maybe. Not specifying very sharply. Lots of things could be happening here. So, we're going to assume detailed balance. Detailed balance says that the rate of going in one direction is the rate of going in the other direction. We're going to assume once again that there's energy conservation. E of x is the energy of the blue system. The brown E of y is the energy of the brown system. The energy conservation is blue E of x plus brown E of y minus blue E of x prime minus brown E of y prime. All of that turns out to be zero. And I haven't thrown in momentum conservation or any other conservation beyond that. I'm just thinking about energy conservation. Maybe the systems exchange particles as well as exchanging energy. Then if I'd have to throw in another conservation law, maybe they exchange, maybe they each conserve momentum, in which case I'd have to throw in a conservation law for that. Okay, so we have, just like we had before, a rate times a delta function times a forward-going thing minus a backward-going thing integrated all over all possible things, dx, dy, dx prime, dy prime. I want this thing to be 0. Maybe I want it to be zero more sharply. Maybe I want it to be zero for all possible x's and I don't do integrate over x. Maybe I want it to be zero more sharply for all possible y's also and I don't integrate over y. So let me think about that case. I'll integrate this guy over x prime, y prime, take this thing and demand that it be zero. Well, that's a case we've dealt with before. F of x is e to the minus beta e of x. And f of y is e to the minus beta e of brown y. Those will provide solutions. That is, here it is right there. If delta e is the energy of the x guy minus the energy of the x prime guy, and is minus the energy of the y guy minus the energy, plus the energy of the y prime guy, according to that delta function, that delta e is just the same in the blue system and the brown system. This thing, if we make this assumption that f of x is proportional to an exponential, is e to the minus beta times delta e for the blue system, e to the minus beta times delta e for the brown system, but that delta e is the, sort of the same. And then we have the temperatures of the two guys called blue temperature and brown temperature. If the two temperatures are the same, the blue temperature and the brown temperature are the same, it is absolutely clear that F, if this term, these terms in F cancel, and that we have a thermodynamic equilibrium independent of the starting points, independent of the initial values of x and y. There's no net flow. Things flow forward and back in equal amounts. The net flow across this little bridge is zero. In fact, the flow across that, the net flow for all x and y, the net flow across that bridge is zero. That's the right statement to make. When the blue temperature is higher, according to the signs we will we recognize as reasonable from this, the flow of energy is from blue to brown. And when the brown temperature is higher, the flow of energy is in the opposite sense. Just exactly what we expect from temperature. And now we are coming to the right place. This is the statistical mechanics version of the definition of temperature that you either learned or would have learned had you taken a statistic, had you taken a thermodynamics course. Temperature has to do with the flow of energy from one thing to another. If we assume that both things are in local thermodynamic equilibrium, we know the sign of the flow of, described by temperatures, we know the sign of the flow of energy. We know that the sign of that flow of energy is to bring the temperatures closer to being in equilibrium. Therefore, we conclude that via this argument, that there is a great tendency, a great structural stability to the notion that we have an equilibrium distribution. Starts from two subpieces, each one in its own equilibrium, and those two subpieces have a tendency to come to equilibrium with one another. If one of these subpieces is big and the other subpiece is small, as in the Brownian motion experiment, grain of pollen molecule, that works. If there are the same argument works if there are 10 to the 23rd of these, as in the pollen thing. So we're done. We have now translated the Boltzmann argument, or the argument of classical thermodynamics, which is sort of the same, into a statistical discussion, and given ourselves pretty good structural stability reasons to believe that I don't care about that. Pretty good structural stability reasons to believe that the statistical distribution given us by Gibbs, Maxwell, and Boltzmann is the correct one. I've now gone over the historical argument. It wasn't exactly entirely historical. As we saw from the colloquium on Wednesday, the same kind of argument would inform arguments being done now about the bases of quantum mechanics, about the fundamentals of cosmology. This kind of thinking is a kind of thinking now being done in statistical mechanics about the exchange of energy between different subsystems and how in detail that exchange of energy occurs. We now have arguments which are based in much more detail on what happens on the exchange of energy. I will have you notice, for example, that delta E is not necessarily small in this argument. It could be a large proportion of the argument of the energy in one of those subsystems, and the argument still works. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
Potential. Because in the case of gravity, we see the thing that you can monitor. The galaxy can stay there and not spread whatever we need.
We have. If you calculated the entropy from F log F, or minus F log F, I believe you would see that despite the fact that gravity tends to pile up particles, that is, stars and galaxies, on top of one another, that the overall entropy increased. The entropy has now two contributions, one from the kinetic energy, which gives us a range of behavior, and the other is from the potential energy. Lots of what happens in the stellar example is that the entropy doesn't change at all. That is, the thing is enough in thermodynamic equilibrium so that there is no change. However, when there is a collision between galaxies or stars, there is then a big deal mixing. That big deal mixing tends to bring the temperatures of the colliding objects to be roughly the same, and the colliding objects stick to one another sometimes. The fact that the temperatures become the same is a fact that the entropy increases. They're sticking to one another is that the entropy decreases, and increase will always be decrease because this argument is right. As you convert this argument to an argument with log f's, and it gives you an entropy which has one sign of going there, and this doesn't have to be a triangle. It could just as well be a star. Further questions? Have a great Thanksgiving.